Hi everyone, welcome back to the UK's number one retro gaming podcast show. This is Retro Asylum, episode 363, an interview with the Caulfields. And at the moment, I'm actually on my own because we recorded the interview a few days ago. And firstly, I've got to apologise for getting this episode out quite late. It was originally meant to record a week or two prior to this, but the Caulfields were ill, then I was ill, and I'm still getting over it. I had quite a bad chest infection, and I think the flu, and you know, people are getting bad colds. The weather here in the UK has been absolutely awful. I think it's rained pretty much every day since the beginning of the new year. So I can only apologise, but we are back, albeit at the moment by myself. And this interview was actually Chris Worthington, was supposed to be joining me for this, but unfortunately life got in the way, as it does, and Chris couldn't take part. So Steve Erickson stepped in at the last minute. So thank you, Steve, for stepping in, because you literally had a couple of hours' notice. And there was no research done. So this interview is totally off the cuff because I prefer to do things the natural way rather than have a load of questions that, you know, most of our guests have probably heard before from other people. So we always like to try and do it quite natural. And the Caulfields, I've got to say, we've spoken to them a few times over the years, and they are so down to earth, easy to get on with, and it's just, to me, it comes across as a natural conversation. So I'm quite proud of this one. I think it came out really well, which most of our interviews do. Think, and that's me judging. I'll let you be the judge. You might think otherwise, but I really enjoyed it. I think Nicola and Anthony did too, and I know Steve enjoyed it. So yeah. What have I been up to? Well, I've bought an Omnibot 5402, a Tomy Omnibot, which it's not gaming related, but it's something that I always wanted from the 1980s that I never got. So I've bought one of those and I'm doing it up because it was a bit beaten up and I haven't actually got it working yet, but that's something I'm working on. What else? Oh, Jim is working on an episode about early Sega stuff. So we will be taking a look at the SG-1000, which is a system that I've dabbled with a few of the games. But we are going to be focusing a bit more in depth with a load of SG-1000 titles by Sega and various other publishers. So that's something to look forward to. And also, we can't forget this, on the 28th of February, me and the rest of the gang are going to be at the Arcade Club in Bury for the Donkey Kong Off or Kong Off event. And that's including Mads and Mark. Hopefully Matt will get there as well, because Matt doesn't really do many public appearances. But you never know, fingers crossed. We'll all be there. So it'll be really nice to finally meet Mads and Mark in person, because Mads is obviously out in Denmark and Mark is from the States. So I can't moan about my journey from Essex up to Manchester anymore, because I always moan about doing that drive. It's a bit of a mission, but I'm not jumping on a plane to get to another country to get here. So that's dedication. Anyway, here we are with the interview. I hope you enjoy it, and I'll speak to you after the interview has taken place. Hello and welcome to the Retro Asylum. It's the Caulfields, Nicola and Anthony. How are you both doing?
Very well, thank you.
We're good, thank you.
Thanks for having us on, actually. We were just having a chat before we came on. We think that the first interview we did with you might have been 2012.
Yeah, we've been going. This is actually our 15th year. Come October, wow, this podcast will be 15 years old, which I think puts us as the longest running UK-based retro gaming podcast.
Yeah. 15 years.
Yeah,
yeah, you can started it.
You can put a film on us called Sheds to Podcasts. Yeah.
I think when we did the first interview, when we did our first interview together, Dean, I think I could say I was 30 something. Whereas now I have to say I'm 50 something.
It's bad,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah,
I was 51 a couple of days ago, as you know. So
happy birthday again for that.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, I'm a couple of years older than that, but still the right side of 50 rather than the wrong side.
Yeah, it's nice to be early.
Stop 50s. Counting. Stop counting at 50. Just stop. That's it.
Yeah, immediately depressing right at the start.
Yeah, the numbers just get worse.
Yes. Right.
But it gives you plenty of experience with the games and what we're all talking about. So
Exactly. And funny enough, we watched the community change over the change is probably the wrong word. Grow is the right word I was looking for. It's you know you've got so many people out there making things to support the I don't want to say hobby, but you know what I mean. It's grown into such a big thing now.
The scene is very different to when we first started. That's for sure.
Yeah,
our community have now got bus passes and are going to bingo.
Absolutely, yeah, and complaining about the weather and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Being ill.
Well, that's what me and Steve do every episode now. I think we just know.
Yeah, that's it. Complain about everything. Me and Ian's dead.
Oh yeah, don't talk about knees.
Yeah, it's all happening.
There'll be people listening to this right now going, have I got the right show? This is, this is the old farts podcast. The
Pensioners Retro Podcast.
That's what it's turned into. Don't stop moaning.
I remember saying to you, you should get into retro gaming of some kind. Yeah. God, yeah.
So you've picked a brilliant time to do this Kickstarter. C64 with a C64 Ultimate has just been released, and that seems to be received very well from the people who have got their hands on one. So
it does
actually. C64 seems to have it's really come back onto the scene in a big way.
It does. In fact, just if I may, we've actually got two things involving Kickstarter running at the moment, and the one that's running that's actually live is actually the ZX Spectrum. And sorry, not to insult Commodore 64 fan, because there is a Commodore 64 activity going on, but we'll come to that. We'll start with the Commodore 64 for the moment, actually, as you did ask that. That we've launched a pre-launch page, which we'd never actually done before, to see, because we know what type of film we want to make. We've been meaning to make the Commodore 64 film for a long time, and we sort of launched a pre-launch page to sort of test the water to see if there was an appetite to make it, and it's been ticking up. I think it's around 750 people now, something like that, and we're hoping to get it to about 2,000.
I'm sure those numbers will go up.
I mean, it's a film we really want to do, and it's but it's just we want to as you say, see what the appetite is for it. So that's why we put the pre-launch page up, because we thought if we can get that to about 2,000 to 3,000, then we know that people will want to see this film. And obviously the film that we're planning to do will cover right from its roots to where we are now. So it's going to cover the whole story.
One of the things as well is the film itself. It's going to be probably the most expensive film in terms of retro gaming that we've ever done, because we've got to bring in that America. Well, first of all, you've got other territories. It's like we've obviously did the Rubber Keyed Wonder in Spectrum, and obviously, yes, there are other territories other than just the UK for the Spectrum. But when you talk about the Commodore 64, you know that there's a large territory in the US, obviously Germany, the UK, other European countries. The Commodore 64 was so successful, and what we know is what people like about our films is we research and bring a lot of third-party archive in, so news footage from the day, rarities and things like that. And it's one of the things we like to sort of specialise in. And I was actually had a conversation with Getty Images today, because Getty now own a lot of the libraries. Over the years, they've been buying up all these libraries or curating them. And we're probably looking at about £100,000 just in archive licensing alone for the Commodore 64 film. As soon as you start bringing in CBS, NBC, CNN, the big American names. Broadcasters, it's serious money.
Yeah, I think it's also, like, we'll use, like, news articles and stuff like that, and they get really pricey.
So you've got to pay for the anchor.
Yeah, yeah. If the anchor's in the shot, you have to pay for
them.
Are you
sure you don't want to pay us to reenact these scenes for you? Yeah. We could have loads of role play. Yeah, we'll put on really dodgy American and Australian accents. And
no problem.
You can't wait. I'll tell you what happens is when you start it, when you start the film, what people don't think realise is how crucial archive is.
Yeah.
Because you've got to look at it. You've got to sort of, you actually end up having to research it several times because you do an initial pass, which brings up loads and loads of stuff that you have to then find, get screeners for or get read descriptions of, because not everything's digitised. So you sometimes have to be careful because if you pay for something, I think with From Bedrooms to Billions, the number of retro docs that have benefited from Bedrooms to Billions, our first movie in the retro scene, because we paid for all the screeners to be made, which other people benefit from. That's just the nature of it. We've benefited, I'm sure, from people that have paid for screeners. Every time a screener is made, it's then uploaded, you see. So kind of, but with the Commodore
scene.
What's
a screener? What's a screener?
Well, basically, if you imagine a piece of archive, say News at 10, a screener will be something that the archive house is allowing you to watch that have time code all over it, usually a big cross or something so you can't go and use it elsewhere. And then you pick what you want to use and they charge you by the second. And some have minimum. So they might say, we've got a 60-second minimum and our minimum is £4,000 or £4,000, sorry, for overseas listeners.
It can really add up. And we literally, we'll pick out the segments that we want and then they send us just that segment. So then once we do pick all the archive, you have to go back through the film then and replace everything, which is quite time consuming as well. But it's nice when you've got to that point.
And you also have to watch archive because sometimes you discover things in the archive that help you shape the story. You know, like, example, in the Rubber Keyed Wonder, we licensed the footage of Alan Sugar buying the Sinclair Brett name off of Sir Clive Sinclair. And there's that famous news conference footage in 1986. Of them, and you know that had to be licensed, but of course that was filmed by several different networks because it was a press conference, so you've got the choice of ITV, BBC to pick, and they're all from different camera angles, so it's quite funny because you get all the sources and then you kind of pick the ones you want. And if you had a really luxurious budget, you could say, let's have that angle and let's have that angle and stuff like that. Not that we've ever been in that position, but it's you see things first and that kind of shapes some of the questions that you might ask people.
Because some of the footage, you know, we don't realise existed. I mean, we didn't know that Alan Sugar and Clive Sinclair footage existed, did we?
I did.
I didn't think we.
Yeah, there were other examples, but that particular one I remember from Bedrooms to Billions.
Yeah, I didn't think we had that with them actually talking.
Do you know what? You might be right there. I think there's sometimes you find something and it's like gold dust. You think, I can't believe it. I found the.
The bit where he was talking about letting people go within Sinclair. I hadn't seen that.
Oh, that footage. Yeah. Sorry, I meant the actual press conference between Alan and
Sir Clive. Where he says about letting people, letting the staff go.
That's right. Change, the one where he says change does occur. Yeah. Basically, everyone's lost their jobs.
It's
nice.
It's amazing that this stuff is actually archived properly, though, isn't it? Because, you know, so much TV, with TV programs from years ago, you hear, especially with the BBC, they re-recorded over tapes and stuff.
That's right.
Good that I know it costs a fortune to dig out and use, but you know, the fact it is actually archived and you guys get to go through it all, that's great.
Yeah, we've got a project which is cunningly called Archive Project. And it basically, since 2013, well, we started out on Avids and then we moved on to Final Cut Pro. And now we're back on Premiere, actually, which is where we started. But this is massive project. And it's every time we find a piece of footage, even if we haven't licensed it, if it's just a screener, we log it. So we can open this project up. And if we're looking for Commodore 64 footage or Spectrum footage or ZX81, whatever it might be, we've got every single possible repository of archive wherever it is on this massive timeline. So some of the timelines are like 4 hours long. So it's every time we find ZX Spectrum footage, once we've utilized it, we then put it on this timeline intact so that if we ever need to find other footage again or cross-reference other projects. So we're at a point now where we've probably got this, probably I would say it's a very useful resource. Hope this isn't boring, actually. Sorry.
No, it's interesting.
And it means that, you know, even the rare, like sometimes you want a shot of the NASCOM or like someone will mention something and you think, oh, And now we can cross, we've got a little bit of code where we can cross reference it now quite easily.
Well, it was the other day, I was going through archive and it was like, oh, wow, there's an A600 in there. And it didn't say that on the description. There was nothing. I wasn't even looking for footage about that. I'm just a bit of a happy accident. I thought, oh, I could use that in the movie. So
can you tag the footage as you go along? Can you just go, this bit here, that's got an A600 in it, and this bit, can you tag it?
I just make a note of it, but if we put it into the timeline, on the edit line, we can just put little markers that says what's in the footage.
Brilliant. And we'll slice up. Say it's a footage of inside a shop from 1986 or something, and as the camera's going across all the computers, we'll log it as computer shop interior, and then each shot of each computer will open up each timeline and slice that bit out and put it on that timeline, because it will save us time in the future. So, and what's really handy now is we can sometimes, like at the moment. Again, off topic, sorry. A film that we're very near the end of now is the A500 story. And so we're right at the end. Nicola's like in the third act at the moment. So we've been looking for this footage of the A500's launch, which is at the CES in Las Vegas, 1987. We can't find, I don't know if Commodore were banning cameras or something, but all the film crews we've gone through, we've even spoken to the local news agency in Las Vegas. And we think we've got another reel, and we go through it. Loads of Sony, loads of everybody else, Nintendo, nothing of Commodore whatsoever. And we're like, you know, what was the problem? They were launching a brand new computer. You'd have thought that would have been a big deal, but
you get quite excited because you might get like an hour's worth of footage, and you think they've got to be in it, even if it was just the walking past and they didn't like look at the stand so much, but it's just there. There is nothing. So, I'm getting suspicious that maybe they didn't allow people to film.
Was that when it wasn't ready, really, and, you know, they had all hardware wires hanging out of it?
Well, that was quite common. I think from what Jeff Porter... Actually, you would know better than I would.
We've got a picture of Jeff Porter.
I think it was working. Yeah, I think
it was working, but...
Because
and it all looks like a really good stand in the picture, but there's just no video of it. Strange. So I think we've got about one picture...
I tell you what, the Amiga 500 story is going to, we're very proud of it. It's because it emerged, it kind of evolved out of something completely different. We were going to do an extra on we were going to basically just do this. It was an idea that actually ended up becoming our Classic Game Insights project, of something that we could turn around quicker that wouldn't be a film, and it ended up taking longer than anything we've ever done.
Becoming a film.
And being a film, which is sort of, you know, we get some stick about that, and it's like...
Yeah. But there's no way we could have fitted this whole story into 50 minutes, and I think we didn't really realise how big the story was, but it is coming together really nicely. But I've got a timeline now of about 2 hours, 10 minutes, so that'll get... tweet, so hopefully it'll be around 2 hours.
We showed 90 minutes of it to the backers in December, and the response was fantastic. We had so many emails about it, and we thought, okay, we're on the right. And even some real hardcore experts saying, you managed to amaze me that there was things I didn't know. And it's like, wow. So I think it's and it's a good story, because it's this skullduggery, and it's basically it'll be evidence of how a company saved themselves once and then almost deliberately destroyed themselves over the next few years with just the most unbelievably bad business decisions and not listening to your engineers. I think that's probably the golden, the main takeaway from this film.
They didn't care about R&D, which is where their money should have went. I think, you know, it's just like, they had the Amiga, which was an amazing thing, and then he just didn't focus properly on taking that to the next level.
The 1200 was so late, so too late. And this is a bit debatable, but part of what we do is obviously we carry out a lot of interviews, so you sort of have to sort of find a channel through the middle because you get differing opinions. But the A600 definitely, how off topic are we, by the way, now? The A600 is the without trying to sound sick, it's the iceberg to the Titanic. If the Titanic being Commodore, the A600 story effectively cut a big hole in the side of them and never recovered, because it was so bungled and to the point of, how do you, if your only main source of income is the sales of the A500, how can I go about killing all my distribution, all my orders flat? All you do is you just float the idea of an A600 and everyone's going to cancel everything, waiting for the new machine.
Yeah, because I thought it was going to be better.
And I was stupid enough to buy one.
Oh, really? Initially... I never met anybody with
one. I got one as well.
It was my first Amiga.
Was it? Oh, no.
I mean, it did work. It did work. Well, it was just not much different.
It was missing the numerical number pad, though, and so many of the games... I remember RoboCop 3, if you bought the original copy from Ocean, it had a dongle that was supposed to in the second joystick port. That's something the A600 had the port, so you couldn't load it. I had to go out and buy a copy from Brick Lane Market to get the game running. Crazy but things like that. No numerical pad either, so certain games you was meant to use that. And it,
It wasn't designed by the internal... didn't mean to interrupt.
Well, no, I was going to say, it was so badly missold because I think it was initially called the A300. It was a cut-down 500.
Yeah. You were editing
this
today.
Literally,
I've heard all day is A300, A300 coming in my right ear.
And if it had come out as an A300, everyone would have known just by the number, this is a less version, maybe it's cheaper and smaller.
Yeah.
But by calling it the A600 and going, upgrade, it's not, it's absolutely not, it's a downgrade, is shocking. It's absolutely completely missold, misadvertised.
David Pleasance said, is it because the logic made sense? Because the Commodore 64 was naturally declining, now we're into the 16-bit. So once you get nudging into the late 80s, potentially early 90s, it makes sense. So we do need something that's at that $99 price point. So we're not really selling much Commodore 64s anymore. Is it possible to have a cut down A500? But Jeff Porter and the engineering team at Commodore had already cost reduced the A1000. They knew the cost of every component in the A500, and they'd already got the cost down. I think by the time, it was at less than $400, it was at $350, it was $329. It was continually coming down. But they just said, no way, we cannot reduce the cost of that unit anymore. Unless you want to make any money on it, of course, without effectively removing the Amiga technology, nothing will work on it. So, no, we can't do it. And rather than listening to the engineers,
what happened? This guy came to them and said, I won't name names at the moment.
Creator of the PC Junior.
But he came in and he said, I can cost reduce it. He got the job. And then obviously it ended up costing more to make than the A500.
But didn't
Jeff
actually...
Porter said, I told you so, you're not going to get it any cheaper.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Man. And you think of the CDTV as well. You know, these strange ideas of, I'll have a stacking hi-fi system and as if someone's going to stand in front of it and play an Amiga game.
Yeah.
You know, it's... Anyway, I think that's
a period of time when everyone was excited about multimedia. Yes. Everything was multimedia. CDs and multimedia. Mm. You know, you can get an encyclopedia on a disc. Why do you want that?
but it was £1,000, though. That was the problem.
Yeah.
It's £1,000. And it was, if it had been, you know, a little bit, well, that's the thing. There's all these what ifs, but there was some good guys. I mean, there was Defender of the Crown 2 that was designed for the CDTV. We're going to be, hopefully getting a little bit more of that in.
Yeah.
But you see, it's funny, actually, we work quite separately. You'd think that we do sit next to each other.
But we don't talk to each other.
We don't talk. Like me and my missus.
You'll have your marriage.
Yeah. And then we sort of meet, and we genuinely have meetings. We'll have a meeting at lunchtime and a meeting in the... So there is a process which we've developed over many, many years. Yeah. And there's things Nicola requests. So I tend to handle archive requests or... sort of production elements that might need. So sometimes there might be sound mixing going on or something like that. We've got to coordinate. Nicola is pretty much on editing most of the time. That's pretty much what you do.
My happy place.
Yeah.
I like that. It's nice seeing it all come together.
And in fact, if I brutally move away from the Amiga for a moment and even the original question about the Commodore, the ZX Spectrum project that we've got up at the moment is actually came about because we were over the years, like if we go back to From Bedrooms to Billions, you get your main film and then we'd have all these games that, you know, we were interviewing Rob Hubbard. We got him to talk about various, you know, Commando and various other soundtracks and same as certain developers, John Hare, we'd obviously do his main interview about how he got into the industry. But in that, we also covered Whizball, Parallax, Sensible Soccer, all those games as well. So back in, say, 2013, 2014, when we were finishing From Bedrooms to Billions, we did the special edition disc where effectively you got short 5 to 7 minute what we call game making ofs. Fairly obvious person sitting there talking and you see some game footage over the top. But they always bothered us a little bit because they even though people liked them, once we got onto the Amiga years in 2015, 2016, we worked a lot harder on those game making ofs to make them sort of little films, but they were still, they felt like extras as opposed to anything. And I think where it kind of changed was a couple of years ago, we made a, when we were filming for the A500 movie, we shot a 4.5-hour interview with Andrew Braybrook. And obviously we covered all his Amiga, because he's got a very interesting Amiga story, which you'll have to wait into the film to obviously see. But while we're interviewing him, we covered Paradroid, Gribbley's Day Out, all his Commodore 64 classics, Iridium, of course. And we looked at it, and when we edited the when we started looking at the Paradroid, we were then thinking of the Commodore 64 movie. This is obviously a few years ago. And we kind of looked at it and thought, we had Steve Turner shot from about 5 years, 5 or 6 years earlier, from Bedrooms to Billions, which Andrew Braybrook wasn't in. So when we started putting it together, we sort of thought, oh, it's nice to have Steve and Andrew talking about the history of Graf Gold, or the beginnings of Graf Gold, before going on to the full making of Paradroid. And we ended up making this one-hour film called Paradroid, Birth of a... I can't remember the bloody name of it now. What did you name it?
I can't remember.
Great, there you go. That's really good, isn't it? Can't remember the name of your own film.
Let me have a look.
Oh, you've got a lot of films. That's fair.
Yeah. But we did this Paradroid film.
It's on here.
Yeah.
I can't see it because I haven't got my glasses on.
See?
Paradroid, it's great. It just says Paradroid.
Oh, there you go.
There's a Paradroid film which we tested the market by, we made it, and we did it over Christmas, actually, so it didn't sort of interfere in, took us about 4 weeks, or took you 4 weeks, and we got a proper soundtrack done for it. I mean, it's self-contained, sits separately from everything else. And we put it out through our mailing list, and quite a few hundred people bought a copy of it, just digitally, so it wasn't physical or anything. And the reaction was really good. And we sort of thought, okay, we've got this 50-minute film just about Paradroid, but we can't stick it out as a film in its own right. So it kind of just sat in mothballs, selling only digitally to people that would discover it. And then it gave us an idea about taking some of the other game making ofs that we've never used before, so not anything that we've put out before, like Parallax. And so that's, we thought, okay, well, that's John Hare, that's him talking about his first, that's how he got into the games industry. You know, he went on to do Sensible World of Soccer and all these amazing games, but Parallax was his first game. So we thought, rather than just doing a game making of for Parallax, why don't we expand it slightly into something like 15, 20 minutes long that covers how Sensible Software even started? How did they get their first game? How did Ocean publish it? How did that come about? And then while John was talking, we then realized that Martin Galway played a part in it. We checked Martin Galway's interview, and sure enough, which had been filmed at a different time, Martin Galway talking about how he found the demo that had been sent in of Parallax, and he showed it around, and ended up John Hare and Chris going into Ocean and meeting John Woods. And we thought, let's edit this into its self-contained film. And it came out at about 15, 20 minutes.
We have got so much footage. We have got hours and hours of footage. And obviously when people are doing in-depth game, talking about their games, it's really hard to get that into the film. If you're trying to tell this particular story, to then go off on a tangent about game making off, and that doesn't always work. So it's been quite nice to be able to do these classic game insights.
Yeah,
there are, and we're going to hold them up now.
There you go. How's that for plugging? Yeah. Right?
Love
so
it.
The idea, and there's an Amiga one as well. So the idea is there's like footage we've never shown before. Well, not properly, but it's been properly edited up into self-contained films with their own little soundtracks. So there's one
and
on.
There's a booklet in each one as well.
There's a booklet, and so you get a bit about each game. So the idea then, we've got, so like Maniac Mansion, Ron Gilbert talking about Maniac Mansion and how he worked at Lucasfilm. So rather than it just being about the game, we add a bit of context to the front and back. So you learn how he got to work there. How did, you know, so rather than just the game, and we thought, well, that way we can kind of make them a collection of films rather than it seeming like DVD extras or something like that. And that's what this new Kickstarter about the ZX Spectrum is about, because we had so much left over from the Rubber Keyed Wonder, the ZX Spectrum movie that we did. And we thought, well, you know, there's enough here to create what was originally 3 hours. And then we've now expanded it out to 6 hours, because there's stories that, like, from the first film, the special edition disc on the first film, we learn about Sandy White, how he got into the games industry, how did Antitac came about, all those elements. But then the story stops. So we thought, well, on this expansion pack, let's pick the story up from just after the release of Antitac, and the pressure that that success would bring a new young developer to follow up that massive hit with the next game, which is Zombie Zombie.
And it's not all game making offs as well. It's like extended interviews from people that work within Sinclair. So that's quite nice, because there was bits in the film where we could have talked. There was so much we could talk about that was happening within Sinclair, but it would have probably added another hour onto the film. So one day we'll do a film that's about 3 or 4 hours long.
Richard Altwesser and Dr. Steve Vickers, that were the key engineers on the creation of the ZX Spectrum, they obviously, it's in the extras, we just have that part of the story, and in the main film, obviously. But on this expansion pack, should it get funded, we're going to be able to talk about the Jupiter 8. They left. Why did they leave Sinclair straight after the Spectrum? Why did they develop the Jupiter Ace? What happened with the Jupiter Ace? You know, a lot of you probably know, but it's nice to actually hear it from them and has edited it into a proper, say, 25-minute film. So it was kind of a way of fitting, because I don't think there'll be much. There won't be. It's like, it's not mining for gold. It's actually saying, right, rather than putting sort of unrelated extras together into a sort of a tie-in, let's actually make it so it's a collection of films that are specially made that makes sense.
We've got a good word for it. It's a companion piece.
Oh, yeah.
A companion piece.
A companion piece, yes.
Nice.
Another example.
Very smooth.
You've got Stuart Fotheringham on the second disc of the Rubber Keyed Wonder. We've got the story of the ill-fated third Minor Willy game and the famous Holt Road incident. We've had so much fan mail about that because we've got the photographs from inside Holt Road. They tried to sit down, and what happens when you give young kids access to money and alcohol and God knows what else? They don't come up with much of a game. Stuart got fired, which is well known. But then this expansion pack, we pick up from where it left off, and it leads to Nodes of Yesod and the creation of Odin Software. So, and Denton Designs are on it as well. So again, we learn obviously the Bandersnatch. We get the full making of what happened with Bandersnatch, and then how Denton Designs were founded and go on to do Shadowfire, Gift from the Gods. You know, there's amazing games that they went on to do. You know, it feels like sort of from a sort of collector myself, it's like completionist. It's like, right, we can get these stories out, and they at least exist in some form. Yeah. I've got to stop talking for a minute. Well, I thought I've been talking forever.
I've been waiting to cough. I apologise. I better have a drink.
No.
Oh, beer. No, that's all good, though.
Well, it should be. We're sort of looking forward to doing it. And obviously, if anybody out there wants to support the expansion pack, the ZX Spectrum expansion pack Kickstarter, just Google it on, just check it out on Kickstarter and support. We've got some good stuff on there, some nice, and we've also got a prize. Henrique Olifus, who's in the Rubber Keyed Wonder, is donating a magenta Spectrum next that he's going to sign. And as far as I know, it'll be the only one he's ever signed, so it'll make it a rare one. So that's a prize. Anybody that backs the campaign, anybody, gets entered into that draw, which we'll be doing probably about 2 weeks after the campaign finishes, as soon as it all settles down and we know who's remaining in the campaign and everything.
Well, that's Dean entering the draw then again.
Yeah, that'll be me going for it.
You're straight in.
Dean 1, Dean 2, Dean 3.
I have backed the Spectrum next. I've got the first Kickstarter. I didn't get the second one, but the third one I'm waiting on, obviously. So
yeah.
I just went for the normal black one, so a magenta one would be lovely.
It would be, wouldn't it? It's but I've got the Chaos One version here.
It looked like a fix. My name comes up, just throw it away.
Yeah, what if I want it? Yeah. But again, you're not supposed to back your own projects. Yeah. And we haven't. But yeah, and I think that these are our first Kickstarters for a while, and it's been quite a nice because we've sort of felt as well the A500 story's dragged. It's certainly dragged for us, but it's better for it. I don't think there's anything we would do differently. I just think that
one of the late additions that really it stretched it out a little bit was managed to get Gerard Bukas. And I can honestly say that is one interview that it was so important that we got him because he has added so much to the story. So it was been worth delaying it just to get him in there
He was the hardware manager for Commodore. So he was there during the Commodore 64 days up until about 87, was it, when he left? 87, 88, just after the A500.
Just after the launch.
Yeah, he's the one that actually ordered the A500. He told his engineers to create it. And he was also responsible for firing the original A1000 team as well.
Oh, wow.
But he was ordered to do it.
He really didn't want to do
it. And they did it. I mean, the team were actually, they appreciated that he didn't want to do it and that he was ordered to do it. And he had to fly all the way over to California to meet with them.
We learn all about Mehdi Ali as well. It's fascinating.
Yeah.
Isn't Mehdi Ali the one who sank Commodore in the end?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing.
Allegedly.
Yeah. What's he have to say? I could be wrong, but... Yeah.
He had his private jet, and he was more busy flying around on that.
Yeah. But, well, they never really recovered from Jack Tramiel going. They never replaced him, ever. They never got a CEO that stuck. I mean, they were literally... It was in through the outdoor constantly. CEO, every 6 months, another CEO. And Jack was one of those old-fashioned CEOs that led from the front. He had a part to play in the Commodore 64. Supposedly, he was the one that said, "Let's give it 64K." But we will find that out, because that's the thing. We go into these films thinking we know a reasonable amount, and we learn so much.
I'll be fascinated. I like the story of Jack Tramiel. I think he's a bit of a Steve Jobs before Steve Jobs. It's quite an iron-fisted, was it called the Jack Attack? What was it? The Jack Attack when he was shouting at people. But he knew what he wanted and he knew what he was doing. You know, I think, was it People for the Masses, Not the Classes?
Yeah. The one thing that I will say, but I've interviewed Leonard Tramiel actually, but we've learnt this from other people as well. If you were a victim of a Jack Attack, one of the things that actually I don't mind about it is that once he did it, he would only really do it for a good reason. And then once he did it, it was over with. It wouldn't be annoyed with you the next day or something like that. That's what people would say. And
Gail Wellington says that
she was victim of a couple of Jack Attacks, but she loved him to bits.
Yeah.
But she said the next day, it's all fine. It's all forgotten. It was just, that needed to be dealt with. And the engineers understood that, you know.
I remember reading as well that he sort of did it to see how people would stand up as well.
Yeah.
Like he was a test of character. If you stood your ground, he liked you, but if you wilted and fell apart, he was like, "No, you're no use."
He wasn't a micromanager either. Even though he was hands-on management, she said, Gail, a few people said he wasn't, stalking the engineering or the floor. He would do little walk rounds every so often and to make sure people knew he was about. But generally, he was doing his business, and he brought business into Commodore. And it was very different, I think, to Clive Sinclair. Clive Sinclair wasn't necessarily a great business person. He was a genius engineer, an inventor.
Yeah.
Whereas Jack wasn't so much an inventor. He was a great businessman that used good engineers and knew how. In that sense, when he left, as is well known, when he left Commodore in 84, he took a lot of the great engineers with him from Commodore to Atari, and set up a great rivalry. Whether it's probably possible that I think Jack would have, if he was still at Commodore in 85, they still would have bought the Amiga technology. But I think Jack would have got an A500 out very quickly.
Yeah.
It's just a gut instinct. Just he would have wanted a Commodore 64-like product as soon as possible. And I think he wouldn't have been competing with his own Atari ST either. He would have had a completely open market.
That out, didn't he? Didn't he get that Atari ST out to try, because he knew it was coming?
It's all off the shelf. Yeah, that's absolutely right. And it's all off the shelf components, the Atari ST anyway.
Yeah.
So it was a way of, and 9 months it took to sort of get something out that's, you know, I know Atari fans complain. I mean, my first 16-bit computer was an Atari ST. I mean, I've got my Amiga over there, but that came a couple of years later.
Mm-hmm.
My dad was working in the music industry, so he came home with a 1040. I was absolutely over the moon. I wasn't concerned. I remember it had a funny smell, though. We'll say that. I better remember. So maybe remember the funny Atari SCs had a funny
the smell.
Smell
of failure. That's what it was. I didn't say that.
This is the thing, though. I think the perception of the ST is that it was a failure, but for a while it was doing really well.
It wasn't a failure.
No, it wasn't a failure.
It wasn't. It wasn't at all.
No.
Take that back.
No. It was.
That's a honest name.
Yeah, it wasn't a failure. It wasn't as good as the Amiga, but it did have like, for example, it had a buffered MIDI port, and that's why it was in so many recording studios. And an Amiga wasn't.
I had one for that purpose. I'm a music producer, still am. But that was one of the first things why I got an Atari ST.
Yeah.
Even though I had an Amiga, it was the MIDI ports on the side.
We went to, I took my son to Abbey Road a few years ago just for the walk round thing. Excuse me, sorry. And up in the corner, just for posterity, was an Atari, it was a 1040.
Nice.
With all their old equipment. And it's like everybody had one. So they were able to, you know, they were able to get it out there. But it kind of doesn't really matter. I think that's one of the things about hardware. Is that, yeah, some Amiga fans will tell us that it caused the demise of the Amiga because so many developers had to cross-develop between both systems. But I don't think it was that big a problem. You were writing a game for the 68000 chip, and some artists would care enough, like Dan Malone doing Speedball 2. He did a different, he actually bothered to create a different color. A graphic setup for his Amiga version of Speedball 2 from the Atari ST, because he couldn't bear to see just the Atari ST version out. So people did sometimes make those differences.
Well, at first it was hamstrung, because the Atari ST was first and the Amiga came after that, and a lot of the games were straight ports from the ST, and you could tell. And then once the Amiga got on its stride and they started using the Blitter and all the extra chips, you then knew this is the difference now.
And the Amiga did outlast. It did outlast the ST. I think the ST. Yeah. Well, at least I think it did. I mean, this is the thing: trying to get information about actual statistical information about the A500 is difficult.
You heard that from the edit today, didn't you?
Yes,
Gerard Booker said that.
Nice. I'm just turning the radiator down a little bit. It's as Alan
it's
Parker.
Toasty
it's
in
hotter
here.
Than the sun at the moment. There. There we are. So, sorry, I have no idea where we are, and I can't even remember if I answered any of the questions.
Yeah, a complete ramble.
I was ask, while you're doing all these interviews, do you ever get anyone refuse to take part?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah? I don't want names, but I just wondered, because it's
Andy names.
Andy Braybrook
so many
mind.
People.
Andy Braybrook, Andrew Braybrook refused to be in From Bedroom Civilians, which is well known. Because he was, he had a quite legitimate axe to grind with the games industry, right. And in some ways, I'm not going to go into it now. I think he's still got a reason to have an axe to grind, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
Some people out there know what I'm talking about, and I think he was just didn't want it. Sometimes, if you think about it, what we discovered when we made From Bedroom Civilians was that we went into it sort of happy and smiley, thinking, you know, it's a film about the games industry, it's all going to be great. And then you realise that actually there were people that lost their houses. And that, these are people's lives are affected. Yes, many people's lives are affected positively. Certainly if you're a consumer, like we were in the 80s, buying the games and, playing the games is probably a better word than saying buying the games, if you get my drift. But but we were enjoying those games. But these developers... You know, some people will live, that game comes out, it flops, they've just lost their house, they took a chance, and you realise that these were people's lives. And
that was the other thing. When we were certainly with From Bedrooms, a lot of the people that we interviewed hadn't sat there and told their whole story. Mm. So it was quite emotional for quite a few of them as well.
Yeah.
And then there's been some people that have said, I really don't want to go through that. I don't want to be interviewed. And then what we do is like a pre-interview. I mean, Anthony will do that. And we just say, okay, you don't have to commit, but why don't you just have a little chat with us?
Works very well.
We're going to talk about the questions that we're going to ask. It's like a pre-interview. And
put them at ease.
Yeah, to put them at ease and say, if there's certain subjects you don't want to talk about, that's fine. We can avoid that. And very often that works. So I could probably count on one hand the amount of people that have said, no, I'm not really up for an interview.
We get, I would say, even today I had an email saying, are you going to do it From Bedroom Civilians too? Like a sort of an updated version, because the story kind of ends in 2013. Yeah. And I sort of thought, that would we drop anybody? We've interviewed people, Steve Weatherall, Andrew Braybrook. There's so many people that we've interviewed since, Stu Cambridge, that in theory, if you did a new version of From Bedroom Civilians, you could incorporate them in. Certainly Andrew Braybrook, because he was very much part of that. And people that we've lost, Archie McLean's no longer with us, and people like that. So we sort of thought about it. But probably one of the interviews that I've tried for a long time to get, which I'm very, very proud, we're very, very proud of, which I'm going to hold that up. See that game? Recognise that game?
I can't because I have my screen so blurry.
I apologize.
Mission Impossible.
Impossible Mission, Dennis Caswell.
Impossible Mission, even.
Nice, well done.
Get back to front.
It's all right. No, we,
Dennis, I love that game.
Dennis is very private. It's and also Dennis didn't really view what he did as an achievement, and it's like, and I sort of had to explain to him over the years. I've been emailing him, trying to persuade him to sit down and do an interview. He offered me an audio interview, a text interview, and I said it's got to be a film interview. Yeah. And in the end, I think I just wore him down and just said to him, "Look, you know, this is one of the greatest games ever made. It's one of the greatest ever Commodore 64 games." And his view was that he was really felt he was a 2600 programmer. Not he only ever did one game on the Commodore 64, but it was Impossible Mission. You know, it's in most people's top 10. And it also iconic, features speech.
Isn't it, that game?
Yeah. And also a single load, which is some people don't quite realize how big the game is with speech, and it's single load and a quick load as well.
Yeah.
You know, it was, and that's something he was determined to do because he felt that he just wanted it to be convenient for people. And he was thinking, as some programmers do, they've got this amazing sort of way of thinking. You think, oh, that'll be good for British users as well who are running it from tape. Because we all remember, certainly I grew up with Commodore 64, Nicola was a Spectrum head, that the dreaded multi-load, which we hated on cassette. Yep. Oh, you know, but so many of the US Gold, the bigger games that came on disc in America, we got them on cassette with these awful multi-loads. Something goes wrong halfway. Summer Games 2, endless multi-loads. But, you know, the idea that Dennis created Impossible Mission as a single load with speech and brilliantly designed, and it was lovely to finally interview him last year. And he's going to be in the Commodore 64 film, and we've got him front and centre in this new Commodore 64 Classic Game Insights. So, and I think
we're building up so many interviews now, and like you said, a few people that we've interviewed have passed away. So it's nice to know that there's probably 3-hour interview of these people that are no longer with us, and you think that's held now in history. Yeah. You've got their whole life story
can still be told. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's really nice because there are a few people that. I'm not sure in these. I can't remember all the edits that I've done, but I think there's some people.
It sounds
in
like
there
we're being flashed, isn't it? Oh, it's, so, it's not like that.
Do you know what's really hard? It's because today I've been editing the A500 story, and then it's really hard to just remember all the other bits that I've done. You know,
so I've been working on the PlayStation project, so both of us have worked on different projects today, and I'm completely stuck in Driver. So I got, you know, that's what my, because I've been on it for 8 hours. And you've been working on the Amiga for it. And then suddenly we're trying to talk about the Spectre and trying to remember what's in this.
Yeah.
I mean, are you guys working 7 days a week on all this?
Do you get any time off?
Because you're always.
Yeah. We're very strict with our time now, a lot better than we were. But yeah, Monday to Friday at the weekend.
We tend to go in the edit suite for about, I get up at 6 and we get a couple of hours in. Then the kids, our son's at
university. Well, our son goes off to uni. It's just getting our daughter to
school. Our 13-year-old daughter's school, breakfast for her, and then back at work for about 9:30, 10 o'clock, and then we'll work through to about 7. And it just, you know.
You might do 7.
Well, yeah.
We can't both do 7 o'clock.
Yeah, I'm not saying that, by the way, to try and be sort of, you know, but I'm just reading out.
Feed our children.
Yes. So, but I think what it is, you get sucked into it, and it is our full-time job. And it wasn't our full-time job when we did From Bedroom Civilians, and it's become our full-time job because we sort of had to do it because the work wouldn't get done. I mean, if you check out Production Base, which is the rates of what people in the film and television world charge per hour or per day, you know, we can't really afford many people to work on these productions. So we have to take, as we said once, we wear many hats because we're trained. You know, I was originally I used to record audio on sets and I was an archivist. So there's two jobs that I can sort of bring. You're a director and an editor for CNN many years ago.
I used to work at Live TV in Canary Wharf.
Brilliant.
Right.
Yeah.
Remember Topless Starts?
Oh, yeah.
Topless Starts. Yeah. I love it.
Part of the Mirror Group. But they did very serious news. Somewhere. So I did the news directing. And then come the evening, it completely changed into another channel.
Yeah.
I won't mention that on your on it.
You're going to get struck off.
But was it after midnight, that channel?
Live TV was on all day, wasn't it?
It originally started with Janet Street Porter and then went over to Kelvin McKenzie. But my first job there was working in like their, what they called MCR, their master control room, where they used to play out all the like transmit all the programming. Mm. And I used to do night shifts. So you do 7 nights on and then you get a week off. So, you know, I was working around Christmas time and the guy that I was working with, he brought in drinks. And I said to him, if I drink, I'm going to fall asleep and that's going to be really bad. But I did. I had a bit of champagne and some beers and that. And I was playing out the programs and I went, this is 30 minutes long. I'm just going to put my head down. Be all right. Uh-oh. I fell asleep. It was about 2 hours later and I looked up, the whole channel was off air. The tape that I played had rewound on air. None of the adverts had played.
Can you imagine a tape rewinding on air? So that's a transmission.
How much trouble did you get into over there?
Well, it was a cover up. Me and the guy, we said, we're not going to mention it. Hope that no one was watching. The one viewer, I think, had dozed off as well. And, we never put it in the book and we got away with it. I thought I'm going to get the sack for that. But
a tiny, tiny addition to that story was I was a freelance cameraman at that time. So this was about 97, 98. And I bought Nicola. I tried to buy her a PlayStation for Christmas. So I couldn't get it. It was sold out everywhere. So I ended up with an N64 and a copy of Goldeneye because the guy said to me, trust me, this game's absolutely amazing. You'll love it. And I came from Tottenham Court Road with an N64 and Goldeneye. And you were the Canary Wharf building. So I went up there that night and we wired it up, plugged it in. And I was like absolutely blown away. We were playing Goldeneye, but I remember passing out, falling asleep, waking up. I didn't work there, obviously, but and then seeing you asleep and the tape rewinding on air. I think something's not right there.
Oops.
Yeah.
All fun and games.
Yeah. But that's long time ago. Oh,
lovely job. Yeah. I really enjoyed that job. One of the best jobs ever.
Yeah, and now so we do
got
this.
A PlayStation project as well coming up. You mentioned,
yeah, it's this Classic Game Insights. So we've done an Amiga one, which is full of Amiga games, all as individual little films. Yep. So you've got like everything from Brains
Blank.
We've
done Amiga. We've done Commodore 64, and we're doing then the third one is the PlayStation.
And the idea behind them is they turn around a lot quicker, so we can edit them. Right. A lot quicker, send them off sound mixing and grading. They come back and eventually we've got 3 hours worth to go out on the Blu-ray, a bit like doing a quick turnaround book. So they're not, whereas when you're doing a full 90 minute or 2 hour film, it's totally different. It takes so much. It can take up to 2 years to edit something like that together.
Yeah. And with the insights, quite a lot of that can be handled by other people. So you know, what I'll do is do like what we call an offline edit, pick out all the shots that we want to use. And then if there's game footage that we need, we have people that we use that will do all the game footage for us. And then they send that to us and then we just lay that over the top of the edit. Same with the PlayStation.
Yeah, in the last couple of months, we've had some quite big, in terms of sort of numbers, YouTubers reach out to us asking, can some of our footage be used under your stuff? And it's like, that's even more helpful, and that's the community helping the community.
Yeah.
It's nice because it's nice that people are actually watching our stuff, and it sort of gets around that we're trying to sort of record. And we sort of say to them, "You're recording history as well, by capturing these games in such high resolution."
Certainly, with some of the PlayStation games that we're covering, they're really long games, so it's really hard, And you might want a bit from right at the beginning of the game, right at the end, and then some bits in the middle. So they're quite happy to do a playthrough for us, which is really nice. But just won't get the time to do it.
And also, our gameplay can be ropey because that's another word for terrible. Because like from Bedroom Civilian, someone said, or was it the Amiga? Someone said, I really like that montage where you kept all the clips really short. And I thought the real reason is that I'm such a terribly bad game player.
Same here.
That's as far as I got.
So once people start actually, somebody sent us some footage for we're doing a film about Shadow of the Colossus and Ico at the moment for this PlayStation project, and just getting footage of people playing the game really, really well means the footage looks better rather than me attempting to sort of not fall off a platform or something like that.
Yeah,
just so we can show the clip for a moment.
I just love the music from Ico, not quite sure you said it, but I love the music.
That game, is one of the most that game was one of the most influential games of all time. Ico, it comes up all the time. People call it Ico or Ico.
Ico.
And that game was its roots are from the Amiga. So I know some people know this, and a game called Another World, which Americans know is Out of This World.
That's right.
So everything linked Another roots World. Back. You can sort of, and then Eric, who created Another World, he was inspired by games from the 80s. its route back. It's quite interesting when we sort of when you sort of track some of these links that someone was in, Neil Druckmann, for example, was heavily inspired by Eco and Another World, which he knows as another Out of This World. And he says that, like, for example, huge amounts of The Last of Us were inspired by Another World. Which is crazy when you think about it, but well, not crazy, but
isn't it confusing when games are called different games in other countries?
Yeah, so those games. I mean, like I remember completing Another World on the Amiga, and just it was breathtaking. Yeah. There was no score, there was no health bar, there was no nothing. It was like almost like being in a film.
Yeah,
and then I completed Ico on the PS2, and I think it was probably my favorite PS2 game.
Yeah,
because it's one of the first ever games where I felt completely emotional by the end.
Yeah.
You're looking after this little girl and, you know, and the things that are happening. And I was just like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
Not many games have ever made me feel, like, emotionally, like, welling up. And yeah. I was like, this is something else. This is on a different level. This is incredible.
Yeah, and that's the thing. If you think about it, when games, in the very early days, if you're emotional about a game, it was probably either anger or happiness from your own gameplay. Did I complete it or did I die? But then as you move a bit further forward into the mid-80s, you started to get these situations of being emotionally invested into the characters.
Yeah.
And it's only when you really, and when you start moving further forward, you start thinking, you know, wow, I care more about the story of this game than I necessarily do about whether I'm going to play it through. It's quite interesting. Though some games, what was it? What was the game that had the 9-minute cutscene that you couldn't skip?
Oh, Eternal Darkness.
Yeah. Eternal Darkness.
I absolutely love that game. I thought it was one of the best games I've ever played, but I got to the end and I hadn't picked up this sword, which would have made the final boss quite easy to defeat. So because I didn't have the sword, I then got defeated at the final boss, and then it played this cutscene again and again because I kept dying. I was like, this is really annoying. So I never finished it.
And I wonder, I have to look at who the developers were, so they're probably hating me for this, but they're
fantastic. I'm wondering if
it is a fantastic game because the game plays with you as well. Suddenly it will come up and it will say your card is formatting and things like that, and you're sort of running across the screen to pull the power cable
or
out.
Or flies were coming across the screen, like, is that really there? Yeah.
But I'm wondering if there was a genuine conversation in the development studio of, we have a 9.5-minute cutscene. Which button should we make the skip button? And somebody going, don't put a skip button in. They must see every piece of these amazing graphics.
We didn't find out that there was a skip button and we just didn't use
it. And then they're screaming out. You know,
one of my pet hates. I work for PlayStation in the testing department and for like 15 years as a games tester. And if a game that we had to test and you have to play it again and boot it again and again, and if it didn't have a skippable cutscene, you were wanting to kill someone. Come on. Oh my God, I've got to do this again.
Yeah.
I think that's the thing where I think sometimes an artist or a developer is so proud of their work.
Yeah.
They want to make sure you don't skip it. Because there were I remember when we were playing some of the Resident Evil games, the cutscene would go to start and you'd be pressing the button instantly. And you sort of think a lot of work's gone into actually creating that whether we've got a cutscene or whether there's something that's important to the plot, and I think that sometimes it's probably a shame that it just gets skipped without any. Our friend Dan, he's a fantastic gamer, but he probably doesn't know the stories of any of the games he's ever played because he just skips straight through them.
Yeah.
You know, so it's a I can't even remember what I was saying now. There we go. That's the second time I've said that.
I'm sorry. We are terrible interviewers, by the way, guys. We just let it go everywhere. So I'm so sorry. Where are we up to? So Kickstarters at the moment, where are we up to now? You've done the Spectrum. Say you're doing something new for the Spectrum.
Is up at the moment. It's the Rubber Keith Wonder ZX Spectrum Expansion Pack. That's up now. It's got another 10 days to run on it. And that's the one that's got the prize, the signed magenta Spectrum next. Yeah. And we've got these limited cards that we're doing, all the sort of little things to make them collectible, and hopefully we're going to be creating 6 new hours of Spectrum stuff. The Commodore 64 film is a pre-launch page, which is also up on Kickstarter. If there's any Commodore 64 fans, all you have to do is go there, don't pay any money or anything, you just click the notify me button and the number will go up. So we're trying to get that to 2,000 at least.
I'll click that in a bit. I mean, I only found out about all this tonight, about an hour before the interview with the team. Like, Chris, jump on. So,
Chris,
So I'm not fully aware, but I'm a big, massive Commodore 64 fan. That and the Amiga, favourite computer, so I'll be clicking that shortly.
Yeah. What games would you say... sorry, I should have said thank you, by the way. I was going to ask you, what games do you feel should be in the featured in the Commodore 64 movie? What would be your top five?
I'm sure you've already got them, the top five. I would say Nebulous... I would say Whizball.
Yeah.
I would say, what else is there? Commando is an excellent conversion. Actually, not Platoon. Green Beret is an absolutely brilliant conversion as well.
It's funny you just said Platoon, though, because Platoon's quite interesting. Simon Butler's game, because it was a difficult movie license, that, and it was done on the Commodore 64 initially, wasn't it? I was actually making notes about that recently. Because I think anyway, I don't want to give too much away. And I did ask you a question. What about some of the American developers, like the Access stuff? Beachhead 2, did you ever play that?
Yeah, they're quite old, aren't they? They're the older games. Like initially, early Commodore 64. Beachhead 1 was, at least.
Bruce Lee was good.
Love Bruce Lee. Brilliant
the thing game. About a lot of those games, though, was a lot of them were developed on the Atari 800, actually. And then. A bit like Drop Zone with Archer McLean. It was actually an Atari 800 game. Do you know, I can show you something, by the way, if you're interested. I have here, and I apologise if I've already shown you this before, but this was a present to us from Archer McLean. It's reversed, but it's his original Star Raiders cartridge. It was his favourite game of all time for the Atari 800. And when we did several interviews with Archer. We've interviewed Archer probably more than anyone else. That we've ever interviewed. I think we did about five different interviews with him, and he gave us that in the end. I felt it was one of those, you know, when someone gives you something that's really important. So I did say to him, if you ever want that back, and he said, no, it was a gift. Yeah. So I feel quite honored that we've actually got this. Yeah. And this is what he bought it. This is what got him into the games industry, this game.
It's a great game as well.
Yeah.
Oh, it's fantastic. We've interviewed Doug Newbauer that made it. I probably told you this in 2012. There's probably fans here going, he's bringing up all the old stories again. But we were asked by Atari to interview a load of their classic programmers, which we did. And we made rough cuts of Missile Command, Star Raiders with all the creators. And then Atari went bang. And the new Atari, I've written to them 10 times about it, and they've never replied.
Nothing.
So we've got all this footage, you know, should we do something? And I've never got an email back, nothing. So I guess they're not interested, but it's we were very lucky to get all those. And that was before we did From Bedrooms to Billions. We interviewed everybody, didn't we?
Yeah. I mean, they might come Ed around Log. Because they seem to have got their act together recently in what they've been doing. Because obviously when they first come out and they were making casinos and bitcoins, it's just like, what are you doing? But now they seem to have got back invested in their retro catalogue.
Do you think they'd be interested in their old heritage then?
Maybe.
You'd think so. They should be, but
they're probably showing a lot more passion for it now.
Yeah, contacting them again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a shame, isn't it? When that footage is just sitting there waiting to be seen. It's crazy, really.
Yeah. And it was kind of I just thought that that'd be, it's not, I mean, that's what I mean. They're probably absolutely bombarded with stuff trying to get that,
you can reach out to them again.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's the thing, isn't it? It's just, time passes, isn't it? But with Doug. Yeah. Anyway, so there you go.
Nice.
I've gone down a verbal cul-de-sac again.
Yeah.
So the Commodore film that you're going to be making, is the format going to be the same? So I'll tell you one thing. I think I met you guys in Play Expo when you first showed off Bedroom Civilians.
Wow.
So I've got a photo shaking hands with you. It's random. And I said, but I think did you show the film off there or some of it at Play Expo?
We would have showed some of it. I think the first...
We were doing some more interviews there, aren't we?
I think you had Rob Hubbard with you on stage.
Yes.
Yeah.
We were promoted. It hadn't been finished yet. We were endlessly fundraising for that film.
Ben Daglish was with us.
He was a lovely guy.
Yeah,
he was.
And Ben was Ben and Rob worked on the soundtrack for that film, along with Max Hall, and fantastic experience doing that. And that would have been all through 2013. So what we did was we raised we started from bedrooms with a little Indiegogo project. I think we raised about something like 40,000 to go, and it was going to be a, you get the idea, 45 minute documentary looking at the British games industry, and it ended up, and then we ended up doing another Kickstarter to expand it out into a movie. And that's why I think we were there at Play Expo that time, doing that, and sort of building the work, creating the work. I remember when we first announced, I always remember this, we first announced From Bedrooms to Billions, and we did a talk at this place in, was it Ramsgate? It was a retro event, which we've never been to.
I was there, I think. It was,
and it was
at Margate
absolutely
years
packed.
Ago. Yeah.
It was
Is that
packed.
When we sat on the stage?
Yes. Yeah. We were so like shocked because there are all these talks, and it was sort of like you get sort of a few people in the front row, sort of 5-10 people, and then we knew we were on next, and we were quite nervous because we'd never done anything like that before, and we never really done anything in the retro. We didn't really know about the retro.
We kind of thought no one would want.
And then
to
suddenly,
come and see
all the seats filled up.
Yeah.
And then there was no even the avenues in between the seats were full of people. And you sort of saying, this can't be for us.
Yeah.
And we realised then, we got a snapshot then of the passion that people wanted to see a film like that made. And there wasn't anything around at that time that was like that. And I think we got a feeling of, it created a lot of pressure that, oh, actually, this has got to be, it's got to be really good. And it's going to have to be expensive, and it's going to have to be this. And I think that's why we decided to then do that proper Kickstarter. Because we sort of saw it as a proper film.
That must have been around 2012.
Yeah.
I'm
I think
sure
it's February.
It was literally a few months after we started Retro Asylum.
And we were nearly killed on our way there, would you believe?
I remember. 2012, I was pregnant with Jessica.
Yeah, and somebody spun off. So we were driving to, and I remember a car in front of us spun round really badly, and we literally just nipped through the gap between before them hitting the reservation.
That's what you need on the way to doing a
talk.
Yeah.
And then a packed room later. But we did, I think we showed a couple of early clips of Gary Penn and a few other people. You probably remember. So, you were there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. And that kind of set us going, really.
And I think with the Commodore 64 film, it will follow the same sort of the way we do our films. It will be interview driven with archive, but it's going to be, obviously we do want to encompass where Commodore is now.
Yeah.
So it will very much be showing the modern Commodore and then going back.
So that's good.
You've got quite a story there. Because if you think about it, Perifractic, that's an amazing story.
Mm.
And we were talking to him even before, that went ahead and became Commodore CEO. So we were aware of it. We've been tracking that story. He's a really nice guy. And we kind of looked at it and thought, well, first of all, why would we not want to include it?
Yeah.
And it doesn't make it accurate if we don't. So it's kind of like, you know, because I know you get some completionists that sort of go, oh no, you know, it's not real Commodore, but it is. And it's a valid part of the story. And it also means it just as the Spectrum Next was a valid addition to the Rubber Keyed Wonder. Why would we not include it? Anything if you know it's the ZX Spectrum Next. So with the C64 Ultimate, it's really amazing what's happening right now, and it's just interesting to see what's happening. So the idea of if the film gets funded, we'll go and be doing extensive interviews and covering what they're doing. Yes, we'll be doing the past, but we want to know what's happening now because it's making it even more valid for today. Yeah. And also, it probably...
It's actually just a really interesting story as well. So, yeah, it's got to be in there, really.
Yeah, I mean, with all the rights scattered everywhere as well, you know, just trying to keep track of that.
Yeah.
That's quite difficult. So,
yeah,
there is a good story there.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, there is a good story.
The funny thing with that is as he did it, absolutely loads of doubters. So many people like, yeah, this is going to be rubbish. This is going to fall apart. He hasn't really got the rights, blah, 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 blah. And then very quickly he put the Ultimate out and very quickly delivered on it.
Yeah.
That was the surprise, the professionalism. The deliveries were landing really fast, and then the reviews started flying in of the computer itself, and people were like quite blown away.
It's a good product.
The level of what they don't, so much thought had gone into it.
I like the way that was his key focus. Because it was like, even with us, it was like, you know, quite rightly, we're on the back seat. He's focusing and prioritizing getting the new product out and making sure it's good and it's delivered. And I think that was the right move, because then it kind of sets them on their way. They've got that sort of that sense of you know, they're a proper quality. Company. Yeah, of quality. Quality, yeah, quality. And people are reviewing it well, aren't they?
They are, but the same applies to you guys. So, like, you're now getting a reputation for excellent filmmaking. And
Thank you.
The passion of what you do shows through. Absolutely, the care, the affection. Even you talking about you building this archive timeline and keeping all that history.
Well, I think it's great that you explain that, because there's some people, I've seen comments on Facebook, sometimes people, they say, why are you doing a Kickstarter when you could buy a copy in HMV and, you know, the money,
because it's expensive, you guys have to make this stuff.
It's expensive, and you guys explaining it, I think, will help people realize, you know, you can't just make these things out of nowhere. It's time and
well, I think passion. Sometimes it's very nice of you to say that. And I think the thing about crowdfunding, the thing about that we've always stuck to from the very first time we did the first From Bedroom Civilian to Kickstarter, is that you're trying to make it so that you're part of something, so you get your name in the end credits and all of that sort of thing. But like we spend time on those updates. You know, you're seeing footage, you're seeing clips. I think with Rubber Keyed Wonder, I think before the film had even come out, people had access to nearly like 4 hours of footage.
Mm.
You know, in one form or another.
Dean couldn't find it for me. I kept asking him. I kept, where is it, Dean? Like that.
Why did you write to me?
I'd lost it somehow, and I'm thinking, I'm sure people have got hold of their copy already.
I'm messaging him going, where is it? Where is it, Dean? I want to watch it. No, yeah. they haven't sent it to me, mate. And then he went, oh, I found it from months ago.
It's sent it to me like 6 months previous.
And you guys scrapped a recording, didn't you, of the show, probably nailing us to the wall.
That's right.
Yeah, we did. And he found it, luckily. Podcast again after that.
But I also, people, you know, that's the thing. We try to make it so that, you've got the cost of making the film is within that pledge. So if it, 35 quid, 45 quid is more expensive than a film would be at HMV. But at HMV, for example, you're not getting a digital download. You're not getting your name on it. Yeah. You're not being part of the production and seeing.
Not getting a reversible cover. You're not getting.
Some people, there's a small percentage of people that are not interested in reading any updates. That's absolutely fine. That's their choice. They're there. But then they don't watch anything, any digital clips. They're not interested in anything, only the physical thing that comes through the door at the end. And then they go, well, why is this 35 quid? And why can't I buy it on Amazon for 15 quid? It's like, well, there's a reason. First of all, we'd never sell it on Amazon for 35 quid. And we wouldn't even attempt to, because it's not a crowdfunder on there. It's a crowdfunder here. And
I think, you know, I think if you are backing something on Kickstarter, it's your kind of investing in that journey, whether it be a film, a book, you know, people on there making tea towels, there's all sorts of things. And that's the whole purpose of Kickstarter, because these projects would never happen without them.
Yeah.
And, you know,
guys are proven to come up with the goods as well.
Yeah.
So it's not like, you know, a lot of Kickstarters, people pledge and they don't get anything. You
Is
guys
it 70% of Kickstarter projects fail to deliver? It's higher than 50%.
It is high. Yeah.
And we always try to make sure that we're updating people. You know, we try and be really clear and honest with where we are. And sometimes the honesty, maybe, you know, some people might think you're just being too honest with us here, you know.
Yeah.
You don't ever want to be
what we want to do.
You don't ever want to be rude, but there just are some people that just never get it. And they just think you're just editing, you're making something to a deadline. And the deadline's the deadline to us is the least important thing. And in fact, if you on Kickstarter rules, it's literally bottom of the pile, because the whole point, the most important thing is to deliver what you said you were going to do. And if anything, over deliver.
Yeah, which you do.
And get it so that it's something that you're proud of. And that's what the 99% of Kickstarter backers believe as well.
Yeah.
Because that's the thing, they keep you going. They support you with lovely comments and messages. And it's not like we desperately need it, but like sometimes you get needled because someone goes, why is this not out yet? You know, hopeless or something. And you're like, oh, and you think, I've just submitted. It took me 3 hours to write that update and put that bit of video up. But, you know, that's the thing.
But the amount of times we get that, it's probably, again, I could count it on one hand.
It's so true.
It's always overwhelmingly positive.
It is, It's quite right.
And then we do get some really lovely comments.
Yeah, it's mad that you even have to justify it at the end of the day, because because people know what you've made and people want more.
Yeah.
And if you're back in a Kickstarter, you know, it's because you want that thing. So these people who are complaining, do you want this nice stuff or not?
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? HMV is not going to make you a documentary on, you know, all the retro gaming scene and everything we grew up with as kids. It takes guys like you who are absolutely passionate to make that stuff that we want.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's why it's worth backing. That's why it's worth putting your hand in your pocket and following it and getting the updates. And then I love all the extra bits you do as well, like that. I made Dean buy me them all. I did. It's true.
Yeah. And the thing is, all the updates are always still there, you see, because I think there's, like, we'll put bits of archive up that we found. In fact, I screwed up big time with an update I put out last Friday to the A500 people. We've been waiting for this German footage of Commodore Germany. I can't tell you how long. It came in, it was 4 hours long. And I thought, right, because we were doing it.
Excited,
we were playing. It was my fault completely. Right, Nicholas is absolved of any wrongdoing on this.
Thank you.
I was so, because I'm such a geek, I was so keen to share some of it, because I know there's some real hardcore Amiga fans out there who write really nice messages. I thought, right, this is for the fans. And I went through it. The one bit I picked was when the German crew went to America. So I got messages saying, this isn't German footage. It's clearly American.
You'd written inside.
I'd written, yeah. Finally, we've got footage from inside Commodore Germany. And literally, because the footage, it's what we call the camera roll. So it's not like the master program. It's whatever the footage was in the camera. So it's got, if someone's walking down the corridor, the cameraman will sometimes leave the camera rolling. So you just see their feet. So if you imagine, if you're going through 4 hours, you're looking for a few seconds that look like they're framed properly. So I found this really nice bit that showed the Commodore logo and everything else, and I just picked that bit. And for some strange reason, I just thought that'll do, because I kind of prefaced it in the update and said, oh, this is just something hot off the press sort of thing. And there was audio on it, and it's Americans talking, it's American signage, it's and I was like, oh my God. And I've written German, so I had to quickly go in and make an amendment. So sometimes you can F up, as it were, with
and a people were on you straight away. Yeah.
As they should be, because I wouldn't expect anything less. You know, they eagle eyed.
Yeah. I think it's great, though, guys. I mean, it's brilliant having you guys doing this stuff. You know, we know. I'm definitely not going to name any names, but we know people in the industry who make a buck out of it. That's what they do. There's not so much care and attention paid to what they put out. And like I say, I'm not naming names, but it's sloppy. It's not done well. And when you guys put something out, the time's been spent on it. The research has been done. And like you say, you've gone and found those people that no one could interview. Like, because we've tried, obviously, as a podcast, we've messaged people and tried to get them on the show. And there's so many of these people who are old programmers from back in the day. Some of them don't even know there is a retro scene. It was a job and it ended and that was it. And they're suddenly like, what? People still like my game? They're still playing it? And then you've got people who just don't do interviews. Like, you've got your Matt Smith and you've got, is it the Oliver Twins? Like, people who just historically will not speak to anyone. And the fact that you guys, because of the catalogue of work that you've done and because of the nice people that you are, they eventually speak to you and they eventually end up on a film, and that benefits all of us. So I think it's brilliant.
Oh, that's brilliant. What you're doing. We have got a few people lined up in the next year or so, actually. We're quite excited about it. I can't really say we're quite superstitious until they're in the can, but some of them are extremely famous, well-known game developers today. Let's just say they're in a...
Awesome.
That we
can't say anymore, but I might have even name-dropped him earlier.
It wasn't the Oliver Twins I meant, it was the Darling.
The Darlings,
Darlings, not the Oliver. The Oliver Twins will turn up to anything.
I think you probably mean the Stampers, don't you? You mean
the Stampers.
I got there in the end.
Yeah. I was just thinking...
The Oliver Twins will turn up to the opening of an envelope. Loads of times.
You open your fridge and they turn up.
They're on... In fact, on the expansion pack, we're doing...
We're doing Dizzy.
Finally, we filmed, obviously, the Oliver's interview was very long, but they, and I mean that in a good way, and they're in.
Did they finish each other's sentences?
They do a bit.
they did when we interviewed them.
Yeah, good. But the Stampers, we did get a message from Tim Stamper about 2 years ago, because we asked him, I'm sure many other people have got ways, you can get messages to people if you really try. And we got a message to him saying, look, would you be interested in being in the Rubber Keyed Wonder simply as an artist? Just come in and talk about art. We won't talk about the business or anything else. And the message was very nice, polite. It said, I'm not ready to share my story yet.
Okay.
So it was like, okay, so, you know, it's something.
Hopefully
but
one day. Yeah.
Yeah.
And we did send the copy to him as well.
No.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Not
to respond.
But we said that doing a documentary about Ultimate with those two in it, being able to do it, is probably one of the things we drop everything for. To do it, because if, once they decide they want to talk, what a wonderful story that would be.
Amazing. Absolutely exactly. Amazing.
I mean, starting off where they did, you know, and working their way through.
Started off on arcades, didn't they? They were starting off.
Yes.
Because with Andy, oh, what was his name? This is terrible. My brain is starting to seize up. Task Set.
Andy Walker.
There you go. I drew it out of memory banks. They had dealings with the Stampers when they were arcade manufacturers as well, and then went from Spectrum comes out, and they you know, the when you got games like Jetpack, which I
he's got all these props to
have. Yeah, they're already playing
what a great game that is.
Great arcade game. Didn't care about Color Clash. Just got it out. Got it brilliant. Yeah. Made it fast. That's that thing. I think there's a wonderful story about Ultimate there, and really it should be remembered because they're very, very much part of British history.
Yeah, hugely so.
You know, a very, very important chapter in gaming history, but also just in this country's history. So yeah, hopefully one day they will talk
to us.
Do you know something? You two should do a podcast. You should do your own podcast.
Well, that was the idea of Cabin Fever, which you and I, Dean, are supposed to be doing one day, aren't we?
That's right, yeah. Down the road, I should jump, drive down the M11.
We talked about the Vectrex, didn't we? Getting the Vectrex. Right,
I've got two now.
Yeah. But we'll
one
do that.
Broke, and I bought another one in a panic.
Every so often I edit a bit. Well, I've got three episodes. We put them on our Patreon, actually.
Yeah.
But the I have to actually do something with that. But the and then we'll probably go back. It's just we don't get the spare time to. That's the thing. No. I can't really be editing Cabin Fevers when we're supposed to be editing films, and the last thing you feel like doing when you've been editing all day is then editing. So we'll do it at some point, I think.
Yeah.
But that'll be great, Dean.
Definitely. Cool. Well, guys, thank you very much for coming on.
Absolutely.
Is there anything else you want to mention quickly? Yeah. Or
do you know,
what I do think you need, we've where done do you need people to go? What do you need them to do? Where are we going? What website? What are we looking at? Let's tell them.
Yeah, Spectrum, give some links.
If you're a ZX Spectrum fan, we'd really appreciate it if you check out our expansion pack on Kickstarter. It's got another 10 days to go on it, and we want to put English subtitles on it and, you know, make it that full 6 hours. So it'd be great if you can check that out. And obviously you can buy the Rubber Keyed Wonder while you're there. And also, Commodore 64 fans, we have a Commodore 64 Classic Game Insights with Dennis Caswell, Paradroid Film, Impossible Mission. They're on our website on graciousfilms.com. And if you've already got that or you're really, really interested in the Commodore 64, check out Kickstarter. Commodore 64, the movie, we're looking for just to go and click the notification bell. We want to get that up to 2,000 so we can launch that campaign. And that's it. And
it's actually called Commodore 64, The Birth of a Cultural Icon.
Oh, nice.
The ultimate documentary. Yeah.
Yes.
You came up with that name, didn't you?
Yeah.
The plastic keyed wonder.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've had the brown beige bin.
Yeah.
The bread bin of doom.
It is, isn't it? But yeah, it's that'll be a lot of fun. I think that'll be again, just to get a Commodore 64 movie done. But all the main people are still here to talk about it. Obviously not Jack, but you know. That'll be wonderful. But brilliant. It's been lovely chatting with you guys.
It's been really nice. Thank you.
It's been lovely having you back on. It.
Thank you.
Thanks again, guys.
No worries. Yep. Cheers, guys.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
See you soon, guys. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye then.
Okay, guys. Well, there you go. I hope you enjoyed it. For those watching on video, this is the Omnibot 5402 that I mentioned just before the interview. So he's starting to look the part now. I've got the battery. It does switch on. It's not actually working, but I had to fix the arms, the links on them. They're working now. He's got his dome. Because before, I don't want to break it, he was bald. We've got him wig. So that stays on there, and that will be stuck down at some point. But yeah, like I say, not gaming related, but definitely something very 1980s. And I always wanted one, so I'll be putting out another video to update people on the progress of that. Like I say, we've got that Sega episode coming up. And, of course, we will all be meeting up at Arcade Club in Bury on the 28th of February. Jump onto our Discord channel. Links are below or on the website to find out all about that. But hopefully, fingers crossed, it'll be a great day. Okay, guys, until next time, take care. Keep it retro. And we shall see you soon. Bye-bye.